John Grant here on the 405media.com. Our guest is Steve Dahl. We're going to talk about his new book, Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. Do I get to read the longhand bio here, or should we just jump right into it, man?
But, hey, it's your world, man. I'll do whatever you want to do.
In case you didn't know, Steve is an American radio personality, humorist, podcaster. I'm reading out of the book here. I'm sorry if you think that's lame.
A lot of that might, you know. I would,
born
you know,
in
that
California.
Might not hold up in court.
He is the owner of the subscription-based Steve Dahl Podcast Network and broadcasts weekday afternoons on WLS AM. He is a member of the Radio Hall of Fame.
That
he broadcasts
true.
In a previous life from a couple of stations in Detroit. Moved to Chicago in 1978, where he worked for WCKG, WDAI, WLUP, WMVP, and WLS. One-time columnist for the Chicago Tribune. He's got some movie credits.
Wow.
What's that?
I am accomplished.
You got away with all the stuff the rest of us could never do, and I had a radio career that washed up about 30 years ago, so I know from whence I speak here. Dahl resides in the suburbs of Chicago with his wife, Janet. Welcome, Steve Dahl.
Bro, can I just tell you, I'm also from the SoCal.
I know that, and I listen to your shows, and I actually picked up the habit of wearing Vans shoes thanks to you. It's all I wear, Vans slip-ons.
Nice, so, man.
That's among the things I have ripped off of from your shtick.
Are you in Huntington Beach?
Yes, sir.
My dad, who passed away a couple of years ago, but he kept a boat at the harbor right there at PCH and Bolsa Chica.
That's right about where I am, just up the hill. I'm not in the high rent district. I don't live in the harbor, but about a quarter mile from there, so I know exactly where that is.
Yeah,
so
I love it out there, man.
It's great. And let's talk about Disco Demolition.
Yeah, sorry.
July 1979. Steve and WLUP did a promotion at Old Comiskey Park. Know it, love it, remember it well. The trick was they'd blow up a box of disco records between games of a doubleheader. However, the crowd went berserk, charged the field, lit fires, and forced the White Sox to forfeit the next game. That's pretty much it in a nutshell, isn't it?
Well, so, yeah. It was. You got in for 98 cents and a disco record because the station was the Loop FM 98. The fire was actually caused by the blowing up the disco records. And people did rush the field, but it was, generally speaking, I think it was more of a lark for people than any kind of, a riot.
The book also covers a lot of your career before and after that. I'd like to go into that if it's okay. But
sure.
to kind of, get the context of the promotion, you had been fired from another station that switched formats from rock to disco. The Loop in Chicago was rock, obviously. So, this was not some cheap DJ stunt so much as it was, a pretty organic reaction to a lot of rock fans back then to disco, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was mad that I got fired. I mean, I moved here from Detroit. I got married in Detroit. I moved my wife here. And then the station switched to disco. And so, I mean, it was a personal vendetta, for me, basically against that station, which happened to be playing disco. Which by that point, I mean, for an ABC-owned station to switch to disco, that's pretty mainstream stuff. And I just, I started playing disco records and making fun of the lyrics or whatever, because, you can make fun. I mean, you could do that with rock lyrics. You can do that with any lyrics you want. You can find something to make fun of. And, I mean, I guess I did tap into some sort of anti-disco sentiment, some sort of disenfranchisement, I guess, of rockers. I mean, really, you could make an argument that album rock hadn't, in 1979, it had really only been around for 10 years. So there was an actual, I know it's hard to believe now, and I know it's hard to believe that it mattered, but as you know, when you're in your 20s, music helps you define who you are. There was an actual fear that with all these rock artists putting out disco records, that somehow rock would, long live rock by the Who is kind of a, I mean, there's a reason that guy, you know, the Pete Townsend wrote that song. There was a fear that it was going to go away.
And you sort of resisted the promotion, I read, because you thought, you know, the White Sox weren't drawing well. You don't want to stand there in front of 5,000 fans in an empty stadium and make an idiot out of yourself. But as luck would have it, they drew, what, about 35,000 that night or more?
I think, yeah, there were like 50,000 inside. 50. And I think another, okay. You know, I don't know how many outside. But
do you think rock and roll fans could do that today? I mean, you know, do you think they would get in the face of hip-hop, or I don't know what the comparison would be, you know, 37 years later.
Yeah, no, I think, one of the things that comes up a lot when I talk about this is, you know, was it racist and homophobic, which I'm not sure, you know, I didn't blow up any Jimi Hendrix records, and nor did I blow up any David Bowie records, so I'm not really sure where that comes from. But these days, when you reframe history through the lens of today, you know, you'll get some different results. Certainly today, I think it would be considered racist and homophobic to try something like that, and I would agree. But back then, there were simpler times, less complicated, and we just didn't think like that, you know?
So, yeah, I was 18 at the time, and my recollection of disco was it was a lot of white guys with bad perms and silk shirts and facial hair.
Tony Manero. Yeah. It was John Travolta.
Yeah,
that's exactly who my target was, you know.
Yeah,
but you know, over the last 37 years, people have chosen to look at it differently. But I mean, anybody who was around at that time and listened to me and knew what we were doing knew that, you know, that's who we were mocking and making fun of.
See, I think real R&B got hijacked by disco, and you know, white guys like the Bee Gees, Rod Stewart, Barry Manilow, you know, KC. I think they all wanted a piece of the action, and you know, real R&B kind of went away for a while.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I definitely, you know, if you wanted to be on the charts, in 1979, and you were an R&B artist, you really needed to pump out some disco. So, and
there was
interestingly enough, house music kind of came out of disco demolition. Because it sort of, you know, it went underground and it got to be a lot rougher and a lot hipper. And so, you're welcome.
I was reading a quote from Harry Wayne Casey. He's KC with KC and the Sunshine Band. And he kind of dismissed what you did and said, you know, disco really didn't end. I think this is kind of overblown. But I think what he was also saying at the same time, he was agreeing with us that, you know, these were white guys who were pushing this product, and it wasn't something that was racist or homophobic, you know, because I guess you'd have to put him near the top of the list of the, you know, white guys who cashed in on disco.
Right, and Rod Stewart, you know, had a record out. I mean, it never occurred to me. Race or sexuality was never a factor for me.
I want to talk about, I guess, baseball a little bit. The White Sox owner was Bill Veeck at the time. He was a promotion guy up and down, and he actually, one, took blame for it, and two, sort of praised you in a backhanded way for bringing the fans in. He thought this was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I really respected him and thought a great deal of him, and, you know, it definitely damaged his relationship with Major League Baseball, and you know, ultimately, I think, you know, he ended up selling the team. But so I definitely regret that. I did not tell people to go on the field. I had no idea it would get out of hand to that extent. But so that's, you know, that's ironic, I guess. And his son Mike actually is the guy who sort of put the whole thing together. And
He says he was exiled for, I don't know, 10 years or something, and started drinking. And I believe he's involved with a minor league team now. But
several of them. I think he works with a group like that Bill Murray's a part of, and he does a bunch of stuff for minor league teams. Where, I mean, that's really where you know, these days, you know, you need good promotion to fill those seats. So I'm glad
you
that
actually
things are back on track for him.
You copyrighted Disco Demolition. You own that name.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's one of the things in the book. I mean, Dave Hoekstra basically wrote the book. I'm like with, you know, Steve Dahl with. So I withed it. And one of the things that I just completely spaced out. What were you talking about?
The Disco Demolition copyright.
I forgot that I had done that, that I got the TRO against him to do Disco Demolition 2 or whatever.
Right.
And I felt like that was like I felt that was kind of uncool of me. So I learned a few things about myself and the events preceding and, you know, post Disco Demolition, and that was one of the things that I was kind of ashamed of.
It also says the Baseball Hall of Fame has the helmet that you wore, but you have only lent it to them, and it's yours, and you want it back someday, right?
I kind of want to hang on to it.
But, you know, you got to be a businessman. You got to be focused on your brand. Otherwise, if everybody takes it away from you, you know, what have you got left, right?
Well, I know. That was what they told, you know, people told me, and when you have a trademark, you know, you have to enforce it, so... But when you read it in black and white, it's like, whoa, man, that was kind of a dick move.
I lived in Wisconsin before coming out to California, so I grew up listening to you, obviously, and, you know, Lou Jack. And I got to say that, you know, the stuff that you said about him was brutal, mm-hmm. but it was funny. And I thought, this is what guys on radio should be doing.
Yeah. Well, that's just what that's what I did. I mean, there was nobody our age who was really speaking the truth on the radio, you know, or at least, you know, his or her version of the truth. A truth that would be relatable to, our generation. So that's what I did. And a lot of people called it shock, but I wasn't really trying to shock anybody. I was just giving my opinion, which was shocking to a lot of people because most people didn't, you know.
Talked to John Landecker when his book came out, and he mentioned you and said, you know, when you came on board at WLS, the rest of the guys had 30 seconds between records, but Landecker and some of the other ones wanted to be more like you, and management told them, no can do, hell no. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they can only talk over the music. I fought really, really hard to get the right to just, you know, shut the music down and talk. And, for a period of, you know, I don't know, a decade, we got hauled into the program director's office every day at 10 a.m., you know, to be told what I couldn't do. And then, I'd go right back and do it again the next day. And could, I mean, you know, it was a war of attrition. I mean, I finally won, but it was really, really hard to earn the right to get on the radio and be myself and do my vision of what I thought a good radio show was.
And for a time, you were off of broadcast radio. You did a podcast, I think you said, from your basement. Now you're back on WLS, and they're producing a podcast for you, or you have some business arrangement with them. What was it like in the basement doing podcasts, or for how many years did you do that?
Well, I had a couple of years left on my contract. You know, there was a radio personality purge of, like, I want to say it was maybe 2009 when they changed over from the diary system to the people meter system. It really affected talk radio in a very negative way. And so most of the big radio companies just got rid of all their talent, you know, Adam Carolla, people like that, myself. And my only recourse, really, since I did want to get paid on my contract, was to start podcasting, which I did, and I did a free podcast for a while. But it's impossible, you know, to make money doing that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you know, you pretty much take the whole thing in-house, sales, if there are any, promotions. And I would have to say, you know, you and Carolla are probably elites. But yet, it's a struggle to make money doing podcasts.
Well, I think he fares a little bit better because he's been a national personality for, you know, since the Man Show or since really
right.
Loveline, and I'm a lot more, not even really regional, just kind of local. So I can't generate the kinds of downloads that it would take in order to make it profitable. So I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of really loyal fans that are willing to pay a monthly subscription to hear it. And prefer
a couple more minutes.
Many of them prefer it to the radio show because you can swear and stuff.
Steve Dahl, Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. We'll put a link up on our site to Amazon so you can buy it. And you mentioned your dad died a couple of years ago. I remember you put him on the air a lot way back when, and sometimes your mom. And, the sense I kind of got was he really wasn't on board with what you were doing. And, I mean, did he ever come around on that, or am I completely misreading that?
We got it together. We finished strong. We got it together. So he was on board with it, and we ended up, having a good relationship.
Great. And you have three grown boys in their 30s. I think you're a grandfather now too, right?
I've got six grandkids on the ground and one on the way. Three
and
married
you, you
boys.
Know, you talked about them when they were growing up. Your wife Janet. You know, sometimes she'd bawl you out on the air, and I thought that was pretty good radio. You know, nobody was doing that again, but
everybody's getting yelled at, so why shouldn't that be part of a radio show? You know, so.
Amen. I don't want to bug you about Gary, but you know, if there's any breaking news on that, feel free to let us have it here. Other than that, we'll just move on. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, Gary Meyer and I had a great partnership, and he's the one that chose to end it. He's the one that chooses to not talk about, you know, renewing it. So that's on him. I'm good. I'll do.
Do you think those partnerships just sort of run out of gas after a certain amount of years, and it's not really one particular catastrophic event that kills it, but they just sort of run their course?
I think some do. That one might have. I don't know. It's hard to know, but I certainly wouldn't be opposed to doing something with him, that's for sure. Although I got a really good crew with me now on WLS and on the podcast. So.
Great. I was going to ask you, you know, if you've dialed it back at all, you know, from what you do on the air. And then I stumble on this piece in, I don't remember which paper, about something you said about WGN. I thought, whoa, he's still doing it. He's still bringing it.
I just say what I think.
Yeah.
And with the podcast, it's a nice outlet because, some things you just can't say on the radio, you know. So, these days.
All right. Disco Demolition, The Night Disco Died. We all remember it well. Anniversary is in July, actually July 12th. Steve Dahl, Dave Hoekstra, Paul Natkin, forward by Bob Odenkirk. How cool is that? He grew up in Naperville, and he's a fan of yours as well, right?
Yeah, he's the man.
I'm a big fan too, man, and I've really enjoyed this. I hope you have.
Absolutely.
I'm not like those a-hole newspaper columnists that you deal with. So.
Yeah, no, I just got off the before I called you. I just got off the phone with a guy had me penciled in as a Klan leader.
Jeez. All right, Steve Dahl. Thanks for talking to us. Best to you at WLS. Everything else.
Thanks,
you,
man.
John Grant here from the 405media.com.